I'm Liam Printer, and this is The Motivated Classroom.
Hello, Falcha, bonjour, and welcome to The Motivated Classroom podcast. Thank you for joining me today. It is episode 35 already, and there's been a great reception to last week's episode all about getting the students talking. So thanks for getting involved in that and getting in touch with me and let me know what you think. Of course, it is the Motivated Classroom podcast, so we must start with our little bit of Irish. And today our Irish is Tosulagum. Tosulagum is three words and it means I hope, essentially. Tosulagum. It means kind of like saying literally I have hope instead of saying I hope, but that's how we say it in Irish. Tosulagum. Now, before we go any further, I think I need to say a huge thank you to the enormous amount of people who have been in touch with me this week, because this week I officially became a doctor of education. So I am now Dr. Printer. It feels very weird saying that. It's been 6 years in the making, studying at the University of Bath and doing my research on teaching proficiency with reading and storytelling and motivation in language learning, and now sharing it out on the podcast. So thank you for all the positive vibes this week. This is my first podcast as Dr. Printer. I don't know how often I'll use that title. It feels very weird saying it, but people keep saying you need to use it. You've worked hard on it. So we'll see. But I wanted to say thank you to everyone for your support over this week. And especially, I don't usually do this, but I do want to give a little shout out today to my wonderful fiance, Imogen, who has been an absolute unwavering rock of support throughout these 6 years. I actually met Imogen on the very first week when I started the doctorate on the flight on the way back from Bath to Geneva, and she was sitting next to me, and the rest is history, as they say. So a huge thank you, Gura Mahagath, Imogen, for being beside me through all of this. I would never have got to the end of the doctorate without you, and for all your meticulous editing and rereading of my work. So a little note to you, you don't know I'm saying this, but Tomin Rolat, je t'aime, te quiero, and thank you so much. All right, listeners, if you're still with me, thank you for indulging in that. I really appreciate you still being here. And a massive thank you, of course, to all of the patrons of the podcast. There are now 24 of you, which is incredible. Thank you so much for your support. It's really appreciated. All right, without further ado, let's get straight into it today. So this episode about grading and assessment and how do we maintain motivation when we're grading and assessing actually came from questions for the listeners. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, we had a question and answer episode, and there was three separate questions all about this from three different people. So I thought, you know what, this is probably worth having a full episode. So thank you, Valine Moreno, Kristen, Eve Boone and Lourdes on Instagram for your questions about grading for proficiency and assessment whilst also maintaining motivation. How do we go about doing that? I think the first thing we need to talk about today, of course, is the basic psychological need of competence. So competence is hugely important when we think about motivation and especially intrinsic motivation. In Ryan and Desi's update paper in 2020, which is essentially bringing together the last 20 years of research on self-determination theory and intrinsic motivation, they talk a lot about the fact that competence needs to come in the form of optimal challenge but low risk. Now, I spoke about this right at the beginning of the series when I talked about competence in a bit of depth. And really what we're thinking about here is creating situations in the class in which students can have some success, but that the risk level is low, but the challenge feels high. Now, that is difficult as a teacher to create. An example that I gave before, and I'll share it again, is when we ask students to do some kind of performance, whether that's a presentation or an oral exam. Of course, there are students who that is essentially very, very high risk for them. If it goes badly and they don't do well and they get very nervous and they muddle up all their words, we may destroy their competence forever or for a long time. It would be difficult to build it up. So can we think of ways that it's still really challenging for them so that they can push themselves, but there's not that risk element? And now this is not for all students. This is just some students. So maybe those students, instead of doing a live performance in front of the class or instead of doing a presentation that can be very scary for them, maybe you give them the opportunity to do something at home, to record themselves on video, and then you'll ask them questions about it when they come in. Or maybe you'll share some questions and they can try and respond to them. Now, yes, there's the possibility that they could have notes at home, but we have to think very carefully about the importance of competence and we don't want to destroy that. So when it comes to grading and marking and corrections in the language acquisition classroom, we need to think very carefully about competence. How can we give feedback that moves the learner forward, but that doesn't destroy their competence? So I'm going to share with you some of the ideas that I've taken from an evidence-informed approach, some of the reading I've done around competence and around building a sense that students can do it. So we want them to feel like a perception that, you know what, if I work hard at this, I can do it. It might take me a little bit longer than other students, but I'll get there. And we need to try and constantly instill that in them, even when they don't do very well on some kind of assessment piece. So when we're thinking about this, one of my biggest tips, I think, would be to focus only on 2 to 3 errors and leave the rest when you are giving corrective feedback in a written form. So if a student hands in something to you, or even if it's a test and you're grading it, especially actually with tests, to be perfectly honest, because the formative work they do before a test, the kind of practices, or maybe they write a practice email or something first and you're giving them feedback before the test comes along. Well, actually, it's much better to give them the feedback at that formative stage rather than after the test. People often spend much too long giving feedback after some kind of exam or assessment. But really, that feedback and exam and assessment doesn't really matter to the student. They feel like they're finished. And the research would show us this, that it's much better to focus on comment-only marking, no numbers, no grades in the formative stage when we're building up to that exam or assessment. Now, speaking of exams and assessments, I certainly learned languages and grew up in a situation where it was quite common practice to have very frequent vocabulary tests and grammar tests. And yes, for someone like me who is a linguist, I would benefit from that because I would go and study it. And if I didn't do very well, it would push me on to do better. But huge amounts of students are not as motivated as I would have been, or as you might be as a linguist listening to this. Many of them will see, oh, I only got 6 right out of 20. Oh, I can't do this. I'm just going to study my maths or my physics, which I feel a bit better about. So we have to think carefully about this. And this would be my biggest next tip. Don't give many tests. Please, the students do not need loads of high stakes tests and exams that have a grade and a mark and it goes into their grade book. They don't need it. It doesn't help. It doesn't move their learning forward. And contrary to what we think as teachers, this is only motivating for a tiny amount of extrinsically motivated students. The vast majority of students, when they don't do well on those, it destroys their competence and their motivation goes down rather than up. And this is borne out over and over and over again in the research, that when we focus on numbers and grades and we think in our heads, oh, but that's going to motivate them to work harder, it's simply not the case in the research. Students do not want to work harder when they do badly at something. One or two students do, but the vast majority don't. What they want to do is give up. And they look at it and go, I can't do this. It's now 3 tests in a row. I've done really badly in all of them. I'm clearly not able for this. I'm just going to stop and I'm going to do something else. So how do we get around this? Give lots and lots of little tests that are low stakes, or that simply don't have a number on them. Lots of little formative assessments and what I would call retrieval practice activities with mini whiteboards. Essentially, you're still testing their knowledge, but it's not a test. They don't feel like, oh, I have to do well in this. It's almost like a game to them. You say, okay, in groups of 2 with your mini whiteboard, all right, I want you to try and write down whatever you're working on. I don't know, 10 different items of food and 3 sentences that you would use for that when you're talking to someone about what you love in food. And then they work together on it. And then you'll take a look at the ones that are really good and you'll talk about them and that makes them feel good. But the students who didn't get it right or there was something missing, their competence is not massively affected there because it's low stakes. There's no grade, there's no number, they're just going back over material. Now, this is really important. In cognitive load theory and when we talk about retrieval practice, what we want to do is constant little reviews and reminders of material that we've done. Because what that does, according to neuroscience and cognitive load theory, what that does is it allows the student to make all these different connections over and over again to the type of language, and the repetitions will help to embed it in long-term memory so that it becomes automatic and spontaneous. That is what we're looking for. But when we do it in the form of high-stakes testing, now for us, we might think, oh, but sure, if every Friday a little vocab test, that's not high stakes. It is to the student if there's a number on it. And if they're getting 12 out of 20 or 11 out of 20 and they have to get their parents to sign it or this gets put into their grade book, that's high stakes to them. But if it's just there's no numbers, there's no grades, you're working on your whiteboards and you're getting feedback. We do this every day in class. Lots and lots and lots of retrieval practice, but keep it low stakes. So when we're talking about giving feedback and grading and we're marking for assessment and proficiency, what we need to think about as well is I really encourage you to have at least one formative assessment piece that there is no correction. It's just a conversation to build their competence. Now, I gave the example in the episode when I talked about reading of the reading diary. They're reading something, they take out a sentence that they reflect on and they think this is an important sentence. So there's autonomy there because they get to choose it. They write it down and they reflect. They say why they chose it, why is it connected to their lives, and you write a little comment at the end. But you don't correct any of the errors. It's just a conversation to show them you can communicate even with errors. It's fine. I can still understand you. And their competence gets increased. And what we do there is, let's say the student makes a mistake 3 to 4 times in their little reflection. Instead of saying, I thought, they say, I think, right? They're trying to say it in the past tense, but they don't. They keep saying it in present. And it doesn't really make sense in what they're trying to say. Instead of me correcting that 3-4 times and giving them the red pen treatment, what happens is in my response, I will make sure I use the correct form. So I would say something like, oh yes, I also thought he was a very key character. And you know what? I thought you would have liked him because I thought that about when in class when you were talking about it. Something like that. You use the word I thought. So they're reading it. They're getting a comprehensible input 3 to 4 times going, oh, it's actually I thought. That is how we acquire languages. We hear the right version a few times and we self-correct. Much more powerful than the red pen treatment. That is not to say there's no place for error correction. The research would show us that there is a place for error correction, but it must be very specific, very focused, and 1 to 2 small errors and nothing more. So they feel like they can overcome them. But there should still be a place in your classroom for some kind of assessment piece where you're formatively assessing, but there's no corrective feedback. Just one little thing. For me, it's the reading diary. I don't correct anything there. So it's just to make them feel competent. And you'll see their writing increase and improve. And you'll see when you give them back, the first thing they'll do, even in the middle of class, they'll open it up and they'll want to read your comment. What did he say? And what question does he have for me at the end that I need to respond to? So that's some of my big tips around competence, grading, proficiency, assessing, etc. Now I want to talk a little bit more about the nitty-gritty, what assessing and grading and marking may look like in a classroom where we're trying to build fluency and proficiency. Now, I think it's really important for me today to say that I'm focusing on output here. And when I say output, I'm meaning writing and speaking. I'm not talking today about how I assess listening and reading. I've done a whole episode on reading. I will do one later on listening tasks in the classroom. But for now, just for today, we're focusing on writing and speaking. These are skills that as teachers, we need to teach. And students, we want them to be able to output when they're ready without being forced. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how I do that. So first and foremost, I'm going to talk about a beginner's class. So in the very first unit, as I told you about already at the beginning of the series, we invent an invisible character and they create this character with me. It's co-created. Then we create a story together and that's co-created. Of course, I have my skeleton script, but they're giving me the details. So when it comes to assessing that, how do I go about it? Students are essentially about 6 weeks into their learning journey here. And these students, for me, are aged about 12, 13, some of them even younger, maybe 11. And what we'll do is they will write the story out as a formative assessment piece. So they write the story out and I'll give them feedback on a few small errors and I give them it in medals and missions. Usually 2 medals, 2 things you've done nicely that I like. I like the use of this, I like the use of that. And medals, and missions will be something to move them forward. So try and use this expression or we say this and not that. Very, very specific for them. And then they'll write out those corrections. So that's how we do it to begin with. Now, when it comes to the actual assessment and the evaluation that we need to do as teachers, they will have to write out the story, but maybe put in a different ending. Or what I do with them is they come in and it's write out the story that we learned in class together, but I want you to make it more realistic. So in our story, for example, you know, the character waited 15 hours for someone. That's not realistic. I want you to change the details so it becomes a little bit more realistic. And then they have to think and get creative. And I also have a couple of images of things we've been using in the class, like whiteboard, marker, other vocabulary that we've been using every day, like door, date, things like that. And I say you've got to include these images in your written piece when you're writing. Now, they don't know that that's what it's going to be when they arrive in. There's been some debates on Twitter about this, about, you know, what's the point in exams and assessment if we're going to practice it so many times that it becomes rote learning. And I fully agree with that. There's got to be spontaneity. And how do I make sure that there is some real spontaneity and some real creativity? Well, they don't know what those items are going to be, and they have to somehow include them in their story that's now more realistic. So they have their story in their head that we did in class, that we practiced. And I always say, if you listen in class a lot, the assessments will be fairly easy. But then they have to rewrite the story with different characters, a different ending, and include these three or four items. And you can see then what students are able to use the language in different contexts rather than just regurgitate everything that they learned at home. So that's how we make sure that there's a bit of spontaneity. In terms of oral assessment for something like that in a first unit, so I set up the classroom like this. And actually, many of these ideas come from Scott Benedict, who presented on oral proficiency and how to assess orally in the Agion conference in 2018. So thank you for that, Scott. So it's like this. Everyone is in the class and I bring two chairs to the front of the classroom. On each chair, there's a mini whiteboard and there's another chair that's right by my desk. So a student comes up first and sits in chair number one, and they have 5 minutes to prepare with no notes, just using their heads and what they've learned and what they've listened and acquired. And they are given a picture. And the picture is something to do with the story, but it'll have a couple of other elements in it. So it might look like, if our story was about, you know, our first story is usually a man who has a crazy mustache and he's looking for a pencil sharpener because his mustache is shaped like a pencil and he wants to shave it off. So I might have a picture of, you know, a pencil sharpener, and maybe I'll have the word in there like train or something like that. And then they have to try and come up with some type of story that's very similar to what we did, but using the items in the image. They don't know what those items are going to be on the day before. They have no idea. They know it'll be something we've covered already. So again, these students are only 6 weeks into their journey. They prepare for 5 minutes. Then when 5 minutes are up, another student comes up and chair number one is now taken up by the new student, and the student who was preparing for 5 minutes moves to chair number two. So now they prepare for another 5 minutes, or actually, to be honest, it's more like 3 minutes in each chair. So they have 6 minutes of preparation in total. 5 minutes is usually the older students. And then finally, that student comes and sits beside me. And so they've had 6 minutes to prep, and now they come and sit beside me, and it's like a rotation system. And they'll sit down beside me, the rest of the class are working away on something, and they'll tell me for a couple of minutes about the story that they've got from their image. So, oh, there's a man and he goes here and he goes here and he forgot this and he's scared. And then I'll ask a couple of other questions to follow up. What's the name of the man? You know, how old is he? Why does he want to find this object? And then I might relate a couple of questions back to the story. So what was your favourite part about our class story? Why did you like it? Who's your favourite character? Can you describe this character to me? And that's our oral assessment after our first unit, about 5 or 6 weeks in. So you can see it is quite spontaneous. There is a lot of creativity. OK, so that is how it would work for beginners. For intermediates, they often also describe an image, but the image will be a bit more advanced and it will be more to do with concepts that we've been covering, like, you know, migration or empathy or perspective or bias. Or, you know, for example, we do a lot on bullfighting at the intermediate level, and I'll often share an image with them of a protest or a bullfight and showing people who are for and against, and they'll have to talk to me about that image. Again, yes, of course, they've done some preparation in advance. That's how we learn. We prepare and we go over things and we try and practice things. Yes, that's fine. But it is spontaneous at the moment because they don't know what the image will look like. They don't know what it'll be. They don't know what questions I'm going to give them. And I'll often ask them the question, why do you think I picked this image? And then they'll have to tell me about why it's related to the unit, why it's related to the concepts. And we might practice questions like that a little bit in advance, but they'll never get the same questions. And then it'll be more questions like, you know, what connections are there between this picture and your life, after they've described the picture, of course? What part of the book would this be from? If this was a picture from our book that we've just read, we've usually read a little novel, why would I pick this? What part of the book is it from? And then other questions like, why should we study empathy? Do you think empathy is important? Do students in this school have empathy? Is it something we should study at school, or is it for the family? So these are all the type of questions the intermediates would get related to what we've been doing in our unit. In terms of writing for an intermediate, I'll often get them to write a certain text type, like yesterday they were writing a diary entry, as a person from the book. So from the perspective of someone from the book. And what they had to do was, we've just finished reading a little book called Rival with my phase two. So they're towards the end of their second year. And they had to write a little diary entry from the perspective of one of the characters in Rival. So there's your autonomy. They can pick which one it is. And then they used, I showed them an image of a war scene, essentially, but it was a cartoon scene between the Muslims and the Christians, which is a lot of what Rival is about, the history of Spain and the war between the Christians and the Muslims, and how now Arabic has a huge influence on the Spanish language and the positives we can take from that, and trying to learn about empathy and other cultures and religions and being accepting. It's a really good book to talk about those type of things. And what we do is, then I'll show them an image and they have to list three items they see in the image. So they might see sword, shield, soldier, flag, whatever. And they have to include these in their diary. And they also have to mention, and I'll give them four specific verbs, like I give them the verbs open, put, said, want. And they have to put those somewhere in their diary entry, anywhere. So that's you give them the word said, so that they'll usually include a dialogue in there somewhere. And that is how we have our assessment at the end of the unit. Now, typically, my students will be doing some kind of assessment, a summative assessment, every 6 to 8 weeks. So not every week at all. It takes a lot longer. There's lots of formative stuff in there. There's lots of little low stakes things. But in terms of summative, where they have to get a grade and they have to get a number, etc., all of that would happen just at the end of a unit. I typically do 4 units in a year. And so they might do a written assessment at the end of unit one, and they do an oral assessment at the end of unit two. So we're not doing it every few weeks. It's not necessary. As a teacher, you can be formatively assessing all the time. You can be recording numbers of how they're getting on in your notebook if you need to talk to the parents or show their progress. But you do not need to be putting a number on their head for every single little thing you do. The research would show us it's not effective. So finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about advanced students. Now, advanced, I'm talking about they're in their maybe 4th or 5th year of learning. They're typically a little bit older, these students as well. So for the advanced students, what we'll often give them is an extract from the novel that we've studied. So it'll be a page from the novel, and this prepares them for the end of year IB exams to entry into university. And they'll comment on the characters, the literary elements, the resources being used in there, the themes, the characters, what part of the book of it's from. And then there's follow-up questions to do with the broad themes. Things like, is technology important to you? What would you change in this school if you were the principal? Why should we study the environment? Why is it something that we should talk about? Is talking about bullying and harassment something that we should do in school? Is this something you should only talk about at home? Should we have physical education classes for the older students, or should they have study periods? These type of questions. Now, again, I saw people on Twitter saying, but, you know, the students will just prepare this so much that it becomes rote learning. And I really have to say that I disagree, at least in the way that the exams are done for the International Baccalaureate. We don't have set exams like tell me about yourself, tell me about your hobbies, tell me about your family. They don't exist. We don't do those. It's all conceptual. So we're talking about big things like migration and climate change and the environment and sport and mental health, and they're the type of things we talk about. Now, yes, they might have an extract from the book that talks into some of these areas and, of course, will lead to certain themes, but they don't know what direction it's going to go. It can go in any way. And of course, we'll talk about things that are personal to them, talking about technology. Yes, we may do some practices talking about technology in general and why it's useful, but there's so many ways that can go. So I really don't think that any of the answers that they give are rote learned. Of course, they're going to look up some phrases in advance, they're going to practice, they're going to try their best to prepare. That's what we want them to do. But we don't want them learning off paragraphs. And really, I have to say, I've never come across that with the advanced students doing the International Baccalaureate, at least, because of the type of questions. They know that there'll be questions about general themes and concepts. So we have core themes like technology, human relations, how we share the planet. But those questions can be in any way or form or direction. And yes, we'll do kind of practice questions in class about things that we might talk about. But every single oral exam I've done is different to the previous one. The conversation goes in a slightly different way. They mention something and we talk about that instead. So we try and keep it spontaneous as much as we can. That's for the advanced level students who get that extract from the novel. And they don't know what page or what extract it's going to be. So there's no way they can rote learn that. For the advanced students, but they're at standard level, so just kind of one level below, they get an image to do with one of the themes. So it'll be an image to do with technology in the Hispanic world or an image to do with social relations. And they have to describe the image and then talk about the themes and why it's important and what we've done in class to do with it. So yes, of course, they can prepare a little bit more, but they don't know exactly what theme they're going to get or exactly what image. So they're still going to have to describe stuff they've never seen. So they can't learn it off in advance. In terms of other low stakes things you can do with advanced students in order to give them feedback, debates are brilliant in groups of four, have a central issue and they have time to prepare and then they debate, but they debate with no notes. And I know they'll go, what? No notes? But yeah, no notes. You can prepare and then you put your notes away. Role play discussions are really, really great. So you imagine you have a TV show and you're talking about gender equality, let's say. And then they each get a role to say, you are someone from a university working in women's studies. You are a man, a CEO of a company, and all of your board is made up of men. You are a person who works in a university where women are paid less than men. And you are a human rights advocate and you have been at protest marches every day for the last month for equality for women's pay. Something like that. They all get a little role. They get 10 minutes to prepare and then you have a big discussion and they take the place of that role. That can be really powerful. And one thing I did this year, I suppose I'd consider them advanced students. They're in their third to fourth year. And we are doing a huge unit all about sexism, sexist language. You know, in music, we often get this really kind of misogynist music that is listened to often in Spanish culture. Unfortunately, there's often very, very misogynistic language in songs. And so I wanted to confront this. And our whole unit was about beauty and internal beauty and be who you want to be and the pressures on adolescence. It's called being growing up as an adolescent. That's the unit. It's a really cool unit, actually. It's really fun to do. And I get so much from them each time. But what they did is their kind of summative assessment, which was graded. They had to find a song that contained language that is just not appropriate to talk about or to use. And they had to share a little bit about why they felt this song was something that really jarred with them, why they didn't like it, and why it's something that we need to be careful of and make sure that if we hear people singing this song or we hear them saying something like this, then it's just not okay. Now, of course, there's an opportunity for them there to come in and say all sorts of bad words, but it's a trust thing and you explain that over and over again. But they can choose also a song that just has good themes in it that talks about equality, and some of them did, racial equality or gender equality or beauty. That was great as well. But some choose to bring in songs that had very bad messages. But the whole point was getting the class to listen and go, the music that you listen to has a message and it can play a role. If you're hearing these words over and over again, it can make us think that it's okay to use that language, and it's not. And so when they hear that four or five times in presentations from their peers, it's very powerful. And of course, they could prepare that song in advance. They could look at the vocabulary, why it's not okay to use this and that, what they're actually saying, what the song actually means, what it's referring to. And these are students about age 16, 17. But all the follow-up questions are totally spontaneous. So what would you do if you hear someone listening to this song? How would you confront it? What do you think we should do about this? Is there a way that we can confront this in the school? What kind of initiatives should we do in the school to confront this more? All of these type questions. So that is essentially assessing and grading for proficiency. And that is how I like to go about it, using the research from Ryan and Desi on self-determination theory and competence. So I hope you took something out of that today. I'm excited to say that next week I have an interview with the wonderful Diane Neubauer, who is a brilliant Mandarin teacher, and she's going to be talking about teaching Mandarin, her PhD, and teaching in the moment, those decisions we make in the moment as a teacher and how important they can be. I want to, of course, say a huge thank you to my patrons. If you feel like you've got the time and you want to head on over to patreon.com and look up The Motivated Classroom, if you think you could spare one coffee or a bag of crisps a month to say thank you to me, if you bumped into me and you said, you know what, Liam, thanks for these four episodes a month, here's a coffee, that would be so nice of you and I'd really appreciate it. But if you're not in that position, that is totally okay. Please just keep listening to the podcast, keep sharing it with your friends. There's no pressure whatsoever to become a patron of the podcast. I just want people to listen to it and push it out there to more people. Finally, of course, we end with our Irish, which today is Tosulagum, meaning I hope. So there we go. Slán Abhaile agus Gur Maith.
The Motivated Classroom podcast is an original production by Liam Printer. I'm at Liam Printer on Twitter, and my YouTube channel is Liam Printer, The Motivated Classroom. Full podcast notes with links to resources are available on my website, liamprinter.com. For more, find and follow the Motivated Classroom podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Graphics and music are provided by Paul Mahan. Intro clips are thanks to the wonderful multilingual staff at the International School of Lausanne.